Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have one case set for oral submission this afternoon, and it is you. So I understand that both sides are ready. Is that right?
Yes.
All right, then. If you'll call the case, we'll get started. Thank you. All right, ready?
Thank you for having us. Good afternoon, Your Honors. It's a pleasure to be here. We're here because 14 years ago, Merit sold some properties to three different buyers using a one-size-fits-all form. They sold to Koch, to Mitchell, and to our client, Lakota. And we have a disagreement with the other side about the effect of the conveyances. I would like to touch on three points today, and I'm here, of course, for you and your questions. The three points I would like to make are make sure the court understands the stakes, why we're fighting this, the relief we want, and then, of course, the conveyances, how they operate. The stakes are straightforward, but the dollars are tied up in four wells. I think the court has seen that. They are the McDermott 1, 3, 1H, and the Foxhall B1. Those four wells are located in two units, and they're the productive wells. They're the things that really matter the most dollar-wise. And it's that horizontal well, the 1H, drilled in the mid-2000s, that has almost all of the damages. So that's why there's this argument and why the two sides need your help to resolve it. Number two, the relief we want, we have a stipulation to damages, so that is easy. We know the number. The question is entitlement. So we've asked the court for the stipulated damages that the parties agreed would be the right number, per Defendant's Exhibit 68. We have asked for title to be confirmed, or as they say in law, to be quieted in Lakota. We want the title to the units that Merit owned with the meets and bounds description found in either the unit declarations or in Merit's pleadings, wherever you want to look. And we have put in the briefs a request for possible shot at some of our attorney's fees. That is the tail on the dog. It's not nearly as important today, and I don't intend to spend any time on that. I would like to spend time on the third point, which is the conveyances, which is our major clash. The oil and gas law has a long, property law has a long tradition of care and close study of the document. Say, what does the deed say? We look at it. That's how we know what was sold and what was not sold. We look at the four corners, as we say. If we look at the four corners of these conveyances, and the three in question are identical except for the attachments. And I just refer to the Wise County Conveyance Plaintiff 6. We look at the granting clause if we want to know what was granted. It would be easy if it stopped before the all cap words insofar and only insofar. That would be a lot simpler. It would be all of what Merit used to own, those Exhibit A leases, would have been transferred to us. But it doesn't stop there. It goes on, and then it says, now we have this limitation, only insofar. So up to that point, I don't think the two sides are really in dispute. But when we get into the insofar language, we have the dispute. And I probably didn't emphasize enough a key word in those next few lines, and it's the word or. It's the line right under only insofar, the word or, because you have a fork in the road that's set up by the or, and the parties maybe are talking a little past each other. The first part, let's do the first half. Lands lying within a pooled unit. So if I have an Exhibit A lease that Merit owned and it lies within a pooled unit, they have now sold that to us. But that's only a half of it. Then we have or. In the second half, we get a little problem. What if such leasehold is not in a pooled unit? Well, if it's in a proration or spacing unit, then that was also sold. Then we have the words at the end that Merit is very high on for the wells described on Exhibit B. So there are no proration and spacing units in play here. That's not part of the evidence. That's not the fight, but as a matter of interpretation, keep your eye on that or, because I think we should ask, what about the Exhibit B language? That limitation, does it apply just to the second half after the or does it apply to both? It doesn't matter. I personally, if I were doing this over, would tell you that it applies to both. I'm sorry, that it applies to the second only. We haven't argued it that way, and we don't need to, because it doesn't matter for these four wells. Why do I say I think the Exhibit B limitation applies to the second piece after the or? Because it's talking about wells. Wells and proration and spacing units go together. A spacing unit needs a well to make sense. A pooled unit does not. A pooled unit doesn't have to have any wells. It's just a collection of leases. Black acre, white acre, green acre, all together. Now we have a pooled unit. Doesn't matter whether there are any wells. But when we start talking spacing units and proration units, we've got to have a well. It's the zone around the well. So if we just walked at this today cold and read this without any background, I think we would probably say, you know what, that Exhibit B limitation, it's magnetically connected to the phrase proration or spacing units. Now, I told you in candor, we didn't argue it that way. We said we will live with the restriction. We'll take the Exhibit B limitation, even on the first half, on the prong before the or, and we will let you apply it to the Exhibit A leases. So if you have something in a pooled unit, and we can find a well on Exhibit B in that pool unit, we think we got that. That's what we argued below. That's the relief we're asking for here. And I think that's the only correct reading of this clause. Now, both sides say four corners. Say you can't quit with just one clause. This is the main clause. It does almost all the work. But to be fair, we should read all the clauses. If you scan down to the bottom of the page, you'll see references to equipment and facilities and, you know, hardware, none of which makes sense with a sale of overrides, as Merritt says was going on. Equipment is irrelevant. It's just overrides. If we flip the page, you see a reference to records, engineering records and so on, geological. That doesn't make any sense for overrides. This is the way you sell leasehold interests. It's not the way you sell a small basket of overrides. If we skip down to 2.3, the environmental indemnity, no reason for an environmental indemnity if only overrides are being sold. Finally, the last clause that I would call your attention to is 2.4. It really doesn't operate here, but I just want you to be aware of it. It refers to some purported asset clearinghouse agreements with the auction house. Those are not in evidence. Those are not admitted. And it doesn't matter because, if you notice in the last, it says if there's a conflict between anything there and anything here in this grant, in this assignment, the assignment controls. So I think we have now covered how the assignment works. They conveyed to us what they owned in pooled units. They did not just limit it to the sale of overrides. Now, they want you to interpret this as though almost everything we've just read is not here and doesn't have any effect. They want you to say, flip to the back, go to Exhibit B and stop. That's what was sold. They could have done that, and that would be a simple conveyance to write. That's not what they wrote. And so we ask you, interpret this as written and award it to us as it should have been. I might stress, because this is a property rights case, it doesn't affect just us. This area of the state is richly blessed with a lot of minerals. And what you write today will live on for a long time in other conveyances. We know at a minimum it will affect the Koch and the Mitchell conveyances, which are the same. There are probably other forms just like this. I don't know precisely who's the grantor and the grantee, but how you construe this will matter going forward for a long time. In our view, Merritt's approach has things backwards. That instead of looking at the four corners, they want you to look at conduct, parole evidence, which is sort of a wash. Both sides have their own parole evidence. We've tried to keep as limited as we can, and they want to look at the auction papers. But the auction papers say, if there's a conflict, look at the conveyance. The auction papers are marketing materials, like a catalog, but you actually read in the conveyance to see what was conveyed. That is the interpretive dispute that the two parties have. Both sides, I think, would have been happier had this been construed in the trial court before a trial. It didn't happen. The judge made pretty clear he didn't want to do it. And I don't fault Merit for that. They asked the judge, would you please construe this before trial? Judge Fostell just didn't do it. So we are here, but that's okay. That's what we have courts of law for. You can construe it. My friend will give you his side of why you should interpret it their way, and then I'm confident you'll get this right. I want to stop now with the interpretive argument and step back and say there are other issues in the case. I'm happy to talk about everything you would like to talk about. If I might remind the court, this has been a fairly long and expensive trip to get here. I'm not eager to have a new trial. We have briefed a new trial point because of admission of evidence. I think the papers speak for themselves on that. It's a trial unlike any that I'd prefer to see. I think there should never have been testimony about teaching the jury four corners and interpretive canons and so on. That's the work of lawyers. That's not something that we should send to juries. And if we're going to send it to juries, we should have the parties involved testify about what they meant, not have experts come talk about it. With that, I will stop, yield the podium, of course, to the court for questions or to my friend, Mr. Luce, and thank you for accommodating us today. Yes, sir.
At the charge conference, tell me about the position of your client in terms of the first question asked by the court.
Yes, Your Honor. I do not recall any form objections to that question. I don't have that in front of me, but I don't remember that we made form objections. Our attack on that question is that it should not be submitted at all, which was raised in a JNOV. And our view is this question, the evidence conclusively establishes our view. And I think for me to get there, I have to persuade you.
It wasn't a fact question to go to the jury because the evidence was sufficient as a matter of law to establish your position.
That's correct. That is correct. And it's not to say there were no witnesses who disagreed. It is to say witnesses who come in and talk about the meaning of a document, that's not evidence. They can talk about it all they want. They don't get a right to say what it means. You do. We say that's a question of law, and you look at the document and stop. If it's ambiguous, then that matter of law argument is incorrect. But we don't think it is ambiguous.
Please look at your, do you have Exhibit 6?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please look at Exhibit A on Exhibit 6.
Yes.
And help me understand what it is referencing that is right about the fourth line when it says that this is a description of number 2913.002 TCX006589.
Yes.
Dated lease date 7/14, and it says McDermott Robert et Dux.
Yes, Your Honor. This line that you have read supplies the book and page number in the fourth column to the county deed records, where you would find that exact lease. The first numbers with the decimal that you read, I believe those are Merit internal bookkeeping entries.
All right. Does that lease cover all of these McDermott units you identified when we first started?
Yes, Your Honor. The
three McDermott property that are producing properties are covered under that lease.
The McDermott unit is a set of six leases. It's not just that one line. It's the Coke Gauge leases. So skip the first line, which is the lessee is Christy Mitchell in the last column. But take the next six. Those are the six that go into the McDermott unit.
All right. Then there's a reference there to down the page a bit to what is identified as a dated 4/29/1953 Vauxhall TH et Ux.
Yes, I'm there with you.
That's referenced twice. There's two different dates, two different leases.
Your Honor, we have now gotten to the leases that make up the Foxhall unit. It's exactly parallel to where you and I just were with the McDermott. There are four Foxhall leases, the Foxhall TH, Leonard HG, Foxhall TH, Burton FW. There's another Foxhall down near the bottom.
Right.
And I've got these all. I skip the Leonard. I was wrong about Leonard. So there's three Foxhalls and a Burton. Those are the four that go into the Foxhall. So you can absolutely correlate this list, Exhibit A, find those units.
All right. What about now go to Exhibit B and look with me on the first page of Exhibit B where there's a reference to Foxhall THB4 about halfway down. Is that still referencing the Foxhall lease that we just identified on Exhibit A?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. That is the well. That's the Foxhall B4 is the well holding the Foxhall unit, and there's a McDermott number 2.
I'm looking at that down a little bit further. It says McDermott RF number 2.
Exactly. And that's the well holding the McDermott unit. These all fit together. You can find all of it, which is why with all the new wells, the 30 new wells that got drilled, our people got found by the people who produced. That's why Devon found us. They can go to this document. They can find us without.
Well, specifically on the conveyancing document, are the references specifically on Exhibit A and Exhibit B to the four producing properties that you're contending are the ones that are the main reasons why we've gone through 6,000 pages of records that came to the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. That is exactly right. They are all referenced there. You can do it. Other people did it. It's not problematic. It's as precise as can be.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So how is your position different?
I'll just summarize everything he said I disagree with. That's okay. Being a little bit of an overstatement. I want to make one point to start off with. This case involves two sides saying what they think the lease or the conveyances mean. And I've just heard from Mr. Gunn, Lakota now has taken at least three and maybe four different positions about what these conveyances mean. In the trial court, it was one thing. In their opening brief, they said, well, it means we got all of your interest in the leases to the extent they're in a pooled unit stock. They used to say in a pooled unit if it had an Exhibit B well. And I understand and heard for the first time in his argument today that what they're saying is it just conveyed these two units, the McDermott and the Foxhall. But the conveyances don't say that. The point I want to get to, though, is that you have competing interpretations of the conveyance. The trial court found that the conveyances were ambiguous and gave that question to the jury. And conceitedly, the language in paragraph A of the granting clause is difficult to parse. But if this court concludes that the conveyances are ambiguous, as the trial judge did, then it should affirm the trial judge's judgment. Lakota has not challenged the sufficiency of the evidence on question one, the jury's answer to the question, were the disputed property interests conveyed under the conveyances? And so affirming on that basis would be appropriate. As Mr. Gunn concedes, if the court finds the agreements are ambiguous, that takes their first issue out of the case. If they're ambiguous, as Justice Meyer, I think, pointed out, it's appropriate to give that fact issue to the jury, and so their first issue goes away. If they're ambiguous, that also takes care of my first issue, which is that they waived their complaints about construing the agreement as a matter of law because they never asked the trial judge to do that until they received an adverse jury verdict. It also takes the questions about the statute of frauds out of this appeal. There is no statute of frauds question if the conveyances are ambiguous and construed to convey only the fractional overrides in the Exhibit B well. The statute of frauds question comes in because the pooled units and the proration units, which are the only pieces of the leases listed on Exhibit A that were conveyed, or the conveyance was limited to the leases to the extent they covered those lands and for the wells on Exhibit B. That statute of frauds problem also falls out of this case. What the court would be left with is Merritt's second issue, its complaint that the trial judge abused its discretion in allowing two experts to give certain opinions, and a question about whether the admission of that evidence is harmful. And so that's the effect if the court agrees with the trial court that the conveyance of work is ambiguous. I want to address the interpretation issue and cover a few points that I think Mr. Gunn did not discuss in his discussion of the granting clause. And I'm looking at Exhibit 6 also. Mr. Gunn's correct. The conveyances, there were three conveyances to Lakota, one for each of the counties at issue. The text of the agreements is the same. They have different Exhibits A and B. When you start with the conveyance, before you get to Exhibit A, it says that the assets assigned are subject to the reservation of rights set forth in paragraph A. So before we ever even get to Exhibit A, we know that there is a reservation of rights. Turning to paragraph A, it says we're going to give you leaseholds, interests. But in the very middle, in all caps, all bold, it's insofar and only insofar. And that language is a limitation on the grant of leasehold interests. When you turn to the very end of that paragraph A, there's a parenthetical. And that parenthetical is important. It says, such rights as limited, being referred to hereafter as the leasehold interest. The language in between the insofar as phrase and that parenthetical is all language that limits the grant of leasehold interests. The leasehold interests are conveyed only to the extent they cover lands lying in a pooled unit for the wells described in Exhibit B.
Okay. You're going to have to help me here. If it's only the leasehold interest, then why is it and other real property and mineral interests? Can you explain the grammatical construct there?
I'm not certain where you're looking, Your Honor.
It says the oil. Okay.
Okay, I see.
Case A, parentheses, the oil, gas, and mineral interest, mineral leasehold estates, and other real property and mineral interests.
Described in Exhibit A.
Exhibit A, yeah.
And the mineral interests described in Exhibit A are just leases. That's all that we have there. There's a list of a lease, and it's identified both by the volume and page where the leases are recorded. And so the mineral interests described in Exhibit A are leasehold interests. And Mr. Gunn says we want to ignore Exhibit A and turn just to Exhibit B, but that's not correct either. Exhibit A performs an important function in this conveyance. The overriding royalties that were conveyed in Exhibit B are leasehold interest. They are real property interest. To have an effective conveyance of an overriding royalty interest, you have to convey a piece of that lease that is affected by that. As Mr. Black admitted on the stand, to the extent you're conveying to me an override, you also have to convey an interest in the lease that's affected by that override. The Exhibit A list of leases also performs a practical function. Mr. Young, the expert landman, testified at trial that without a list of those leases, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to locate those wells listed on Exhibit B on the ground. You need the lease list to identify those wells for which fractional overrides were conveyed. The Exhibit B, the wells described on Exhibit B, is a part of the limitation on the grant of leasehold interests. And when you look to Exhibit B, what you'll see is the name of a well, the name of the operator of that well, and on the Exhibit Bs in this case, the operators, none of the wells listed are operated by Merritt. Merritt was not intending to convey any of its operated interest. All of the operators listed on Exhibit B are different companies, not Merritt. In the far right-hand column, under the heading...
Let me understand, yes, that. On Exhibit B, you were intending to sell those interests listed on Exhibit B.
Yes, sir.
And the Exhibit B lists the two, the McDermott and the Foxhall.
Those are two wells that were conveyed that have a fractional overriding royalty interest associated with them and no working interest.
And the leases were conveyed on Exhibit A.
The leases were conveyed, but the leasehold interest conveyed was limited as set forth therein. The leasehold interests were limited to lands lying within a pooled unit for the wells described in Exhibit B. The information on Exhibit B is a part of the limitation of the grant of leasehold interest described in Exhibit A. Exhibit B lists specific wells, and in the far right-hand column, under NRI percentage, it lists a fractional overriding royalty with two exceptions. In the column next to the far right column, under working interest, it's all zeros with those two exceptions. There was no working interest granted in any of the wells identified on Exhibit B, and that's an important limitation on this grant.
Well, when we look at the testimony that came in from Mr. Diem,
yes, sir.
It's kind of amazing to me as I read through all this testimony from Mr. Diem and from Mr. Young and from the other witnesses that seem to come in at the request of your client that impeaches the testimony of Mr. Diem. He just wasn't right. We say, okay, look, when Mr. Diem comes in and says, we weren't looking at a set form, the only that's probably that what caused the mistake here, the only situation I know of that we had a form for was the assignment form for auction, because what we sold at auction was generally, pardon the term, junk. We didn't pay attention to it. That's on page 101, starting at line 2. And then you go over to his testimony that what was being sold, and the question that was asked on page 10, starting at the bottom of 106 of the record is, my question is, and I'm not trying to press you, would you look at the document, look at the first page of Exhibit 6, 7, or 8, and let me know whether you believe that that document purports to convey interest in leaseholds in addition to overrides? Answer, yes, it does. Now, this is the man that signed it, and he's the vice president and general counsel of the company at the time. Why isn't that a controlling testimony from the main person that was there as far as the company's concerned on this transaction?
Mr. Diem also testified very clearly, though, that he had no intent to convey any operated interest, that the agreements were intended only to convey overrides in those specific wells.
He said that what he thought was overrides is all we were starting out to try to sell, but he specifically said here in this language I just read to you that, in fact, the conveyancing documents do convey interest in leaseholds in addition to overrides.
He said that, and I think his testimony regarding what he intended is not entirely clear, except that he did say it would be ridiculous to say that Lakota received operated interest because they never intended to convey more than that. And that's the same testimony as Mr. Brister and Anna McMahon. We only intended to convey non-operated pieces. We didn't intend to convey.
And that's not language in the conveyancing documents anywhere, is it, sir? Nothing in the conveying document, in the conveying instruments say that. You go to these piecemeals and you look at the insofar and all the other language that's attempting to put in the conveyancing documents a limitation, but it doesn't really reach the leaseholds that are listed on the Exhibit A.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. If you look at the structure of the granting clause, it really is broken up into two pieces. The first piece grants, and the second half, following the insofar and only insofar language, limits the grant of leasehold interest. It is limited for lands lying in a pooled or proration unit for the wells described in Exhibit B. Exhibit B is an important part of the limitation on the grant of leasehold interest. And it's Exhibit B that Lakota's interpretation of these documents ignores. Their interpretation to say, we got all of what you had in the Exhibit A leases and pooled units, I think as Mr. Gunn said, it would be great if we could just stop reading right there, but we cannot. There has to be some meaning to the description of wells listed on Exhibit B. And when you look at that, It is all non-operated interest. It is all zero working interest in the wells listed, and only a fractional override in the wells listed. Why bother if the intent in this agreement was to convey 100% of Merit's working interest? Why bother going through 90-some-odd wells listing fractional overrides to the 0.1% if those would be completely subsumed within the 100% working interest that that Lakota now claims?
Help me understand why there's a need for an assumption and indemnity clause.
You can ignore the light.
Assumption and indemnity clause if there is nothing being sold except overriding royalty interest.
I think that Mr. Deem testified that these were form conveyances that were used to convey whatever interest they had to sell at auction. He said they would be used for leasehold interest or for overrides or for whatever. I want to address briefly in Exhibit B and C, there is a reference to equipment, and in paragraph C, it refers to, I think, various records. Both of those paragraphs start, to the extent same are specifically attributable or allocable to the leasehold interest. Leasehold interest is what we defined in paragraph A as the rights as limited by the language that follows the insofar as clause. One thing I haven't gotten to, Your Honors, is that under the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in Houston Exploration, this language ought to be construed in light of the circumstances surrounding the sale. The circumstances surrounding the sale include the auction documents. The only thing that Merit took to auction were these fractional overrides in specific wells. That's what Lakota saw in the brochure, that's what it saw in the auction catalog, and that's what it saw in the invoice it received from the auction. Lakota intended to purchase the mineral interest in lot 85 sold at auction. And if you look at the conveyances, every one of them says sale 155C. That's the auction sale. Every one of them says lot 85 on the front page. Every exhibit A and exhibit B includes a reference to lot 85. That auction sale was what this conveyance was meant to effectuate, and that auction sale included only fractional overrides in the specific wells. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, not so fast. There may be more questions.
I am happy to answer any questions that you have.
Do you have any questions?
This would probably be an ignorant question, but I'm just curious to know whether if working interests were transferred, Lakota would have been receiving bills for expenses for development and production over the years that it possessed these interests. Or could it be? Well, yeah, they would have been operated interests.
If operated interests had been conveyed under these documents, then Lakota would have been the one operating these leases. And the testimony is undisputed that for 10 years following the sale, Merit continued to operate the leases, to pay taxes, to pay royalties, continued to develop these leases, and its conduct in operating these leases was open and obvious to anyone. Lakota operated wells in this same field. It would have been obvious to them. And that's an important question. If Lakota intended to purchase these 100% working interest, why for 10 years did it say nothing? And why wasn't the very first question it asked after this auction, where are the pooled units? They didn't say anything about that because that didn't matter to them. The issue in this case goes to the intent of the parties. And that intent is difficult to discern from the language of the conveyances alone. But when you look at the circumstances surrounding this sale, there just cannot be any question that Lakota did not intend to buy anything but overrides and never believed it had done so until it received a mistaken letter from Devon. Merit never intended to sell anything but fractional overrides in those wells. It never intended to sell any of its operating interest. This court should affirm. If it doesn't affirm, if it construed these as Lakota is saying, a new trial would be required to try the many other issues, claims and defenses that were not reached by the jury. And if it construes these as Lakota says, a new trial would be required as well, which I think goes to why there was a waiver on their first issue. I'm happy to answer.
I have one other question.
Yes, sir.
No, you go ahead. This is the whole show today.
Presentation of the evidence. What evidence was there of the intent of the merit companies other than that was direct? I'm not talking about indirect testimony like the offering of what's in a brochure or in the catalog or by testimony from experts. What evidence was there that was direct evidence of the intent other than the testimony of Mr. Dean?
Chad Brister testified that
I remember reading Brister.
There was no intent to sell anything but overrides.
And his direct involvement was?
He was with the company at the time.
No, what was his direct involvement in this transaction?
I don't recall that.
He didn't have any, best I remember. And there was a lady who was making copies, and she said we wouldn't have to make copies if we hadn't had some different interest.
With respect, Your Honor, the copying was one reason why she remembered this transaction, but she remembered that this transaction did not involve any of the operating interest. It involved only the
Brister, who didn't have anything to do with it, and the lady who was making copies. And then we've got one other lady whose name is, forgotten her name.
Bradley, perhaps.
Yes. And her, what was her direct involvement in the transaction?
I don't recall.
Main person that had direct involvement in terms of intent of the parties, in terms of actually involved in the transaction, was Mr. Diem.
And Mr. Diem said it would be ridiculous to say we conveyed our operating interest to Lakota.
And then he admitted that, in fact, there was interest transferred, like the language I read to you.
This case goes to the intent of the parties in the agreement. He had no intent to convey anything but the fractional overrides. There was no intent to convey operated working interests.
I understand. Thank you very much for answering my question, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have any questions?
No more questions.
I'm sorry, was there another?
Well, I'm checking. No more? No more?
No more.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal. We're here for the court, but tell the court's prepared, and we've made the points we came to make. And
let me see if there are any other questions.
Yes.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Do you have any questions?
I'd like your interpretation of what was direct evidence in terms of the intent of the parties, if you have one.
I think the only reliable direct evidence you can look at is the conveyance. There is correspondence from the Black family writing to Paula Mayberger, raising a worry about the meeting. It's a letter raising a worry about what does this mean. Let me get the exhibit number. Plaintiff's 13, saying this looks problematic, but once we start down the slope of departing from the document, I think we then just have a food fight.
Mr. Black's letter I'm looking at is Trial Exhibit 23, the handwritten letter dated September the 2nd.
No, that's a different one, Your Honor. I'm looking at Plaintiff's 13, which was a letter early on from Carl Black saying, you know, here's our attorney and what our attorney reads this lease to mean.
Okay.
That's the one. That's the only other evidence. So.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for having us.
All right. Thank you. We appreciate your argument and your briefing. Your case is submitted. I guess we have no more questions, although we'll probably come up with a lot more questions once we go into post-submission conference. But as I said, we do appreciate you coming in today, and we appreciate your argument and your briefing, and your case is submitted. We will